You've lost 2 or 3 pounds. It hasn't affected your looks yet, but you can't lose any more. She gazes into thin air, as if waiting for her voice box string to be pulled before she recites recorded messages. Don't think you can starve yourself until you're haggard and unattractive. You can't escape me that way, Ariel. I'll strap you down and force-feed you if I have to. I'll make you swallow a rubber tube and pump baby food into your stomach. In fact, I'd enjoy it. Do you like pureed peas? Carrots? Applesauce? I guess it doesn't matter since you won't taste them unless you regurgitate. He gazes at her silken hair, which is red-blonde in the filtered light. This sight translates through all 5 of Vess's extraordinary senses, and he is bathed in the sensory splendor of her hair, in all of the sounds and smells and textures that the look of it conveys to him. One stimulus has so many associations for him that he could lose himself for hours in the contemplation of a single hair or one drop of rain if he chose, because that item would become an entire world of sensation to him. He moves to the armchair and stands over the girl. She doesn't acknowledge him, and although he has entered her line of sight, her gaze has somehow shifted above and to one side of him without his being aware of the movement when it happened. She is magically evasive. Maybe I could get a word or two out of you if I set you on fire. What do you think? Hmm? A little lighter fluid on that golden hair. And whoosh. She does not blink. Or I'll give you to the dogs. See if that unties your tongue. No flinch, no tick, no shudder. What a girl. Mr. Vess stoops, lowering his face toward Ariel's until they are nose to nose. Her eyes are now directly aligned with his, yet she is still not looking at him. She seems to peer through him as if he is not a man of flesh and blood, but a haunting spirit that she can't quite detect. This isn't merely the old trick of letting her eyes swim out of focus. It's a ruse infinitely more clever than that, which he can't understand at all. Nose to nose with her, Vess whispers, "We'll go to the meadow after midnight. I'll bury Laura and the hitchhiker. Maybe I'll put you into the ground with them and cover you up, 3 in 1 grave, them dead and you alive. Would you speak then, Ariel? Would you say please?" No answer. He waits. Her breathing is low and even. He is so close to her that her exhalations are warm and steady against his lips, like promises of kisses to come. She must feel his breath, too. She may be frightened of him and even repulsed by him, but she also finds him alluring. He has no doubt about this. Everyone is fascinated by bad boys. He says, "Maybe they'll be stars." Such a blueness in her eyes, such sparkling depths. "Or even moonlight," he whispers. The steel cuffs on China's ankles were linked by a sturdy chain. A second and far longer chain, connected by a carabiner to the first, wound around the thick legs of the chair and around the stretcher bars between the legs, returned between her feet, encircled the big barrel that supported the round table, and connected again to the carabiner. The chains didn't contain enough play to allow her to stand. Even if she'd been able to stand, she would have had to carry the chair on her back, and the restricting shape and the weight of it would have forced her to bend forward like a hunchback troll, and once again she could not have moved from the table to which she was tethered. Her hands were cuffed in front of her. A chain was hooked into the shackle that encircled her right wrist. From there it led around her, wound between the back rails of the chair behind the tie-on pad, then to the shackle on her left wrist. This chain contained enough slack to allow her to rest her arms on the table if she wished. She sat with her hands folded, leaning forward, staring at the red and swollen index finger on her right hand, waiting. Her finger throbbed and she had a headache, but her neck pain had subsided. She knew that it would return worse than ever in another 24 hours, like the delayed agony of severe whiplash. Of course, if she was still alive in another 24 hours, neck pain would be the least of her worries. The Doberman was no longer at the window. She had seen 2 at once on the lawn, padding back and forth, sniffing the grass in the air, pausing occasionally to prick their ears and listen intently, then padding away again, obviously on guard duty. During the previous night, China had used rage to overcome her terror before it had incapacitated her, but now she discovered that humiliation was even more effective at quelling fear. Having been unable to protect herself, having wound up in bondage, that was not the source of her humiliation. What mortified worse was her failure to fulfill her promise to the girl in the cellar. "I am your guardian. I'll keep you safe. She kept returning in memory to the upholstered vestibule and the viewport on the inner door. The girl among the dolls had given no indication that she had heard the promise. But China was sick with the certainty that she had raised false hopes, that the girl would feel betrayed and more abandoned than ever, and that she would withdraw even further into her private elsewhere. I am your guardian. In retrospect, China found her arrogance not merely astonishing, but perverse, delusional. In 26 years of living, she'd never saved anyone in any sense whatsoever. She was no heroine, no mystery novel series character with just a colorful dash of angst and a soupçon of endearing character flaws and otherwise the competence of Sherlock Holmes and James Bond combined. Keeping herself alive, mentally stable, and emotionally intact had been enough of a struggle for her. She was still a lost girl herself, fumbling blindly through the years for some insight or resolution that probably wasn't even out there to be found, yet she'd stood at that viewport and promised deliverance. I am your guardian. She opened her folded hands. She flattened her hands on the table and slid them across the wood as if smoothing away wrinkles in a tablecloth, and as she moved, her chains rattled. She wasn't a fighter, after all, no one's paladin. She worked as a waitress. She was good at it, piling up tips because 16 years in her mother's bent world had taught her that one way to ensure survival was to be ingratiating. With her customers, she was indefatigably charming, relentlessly agreeable, and always eager to please. The relationship between a diner and a waitress was, to her way of thinking, the ideal relationship, because it was brief, formal, generally conducted with a high degree of politeness, and required no bearing of the heart. I am your guardian. In her obsessive determination to protect herself at all costs, she was always friendly with the other waitresses where she worked, but she never made friends with any of them. Friendships involved commitment, risks. She had learned not to make herself vulnerable to the hurt and betrayal that ensued from commitments. Over the years, she'd had affairs with only two men. She had liked both and had loved the second, but the first relationship had lasted 11 months and the second only 13. Lovers, if they were worthwhile, required more than simple commitment. They needed revelation, sharing the bond of emotional intimacy. She found it difficult to reveal much about her childhood or her mother, in part because her utter helplessness during those years embarrassed her. More to the point, she had come to the hard realization that her mother had never really loved her, perhaps had never been capable of loving her or anyone. And how could she expect to be cherished by any man who knew that she'd been unloved even by her mother? She was aware that this attitude was irrational, but awareness didn't free her. She understood that she was not responsible for what her mother had done to her, but regardless of what so many therapists claimed in their books and on their radio talk shows, understanding alone didn't lead to healing. Even after a decade beyond her mother's control, China was at times convinced that all the dark events of all those troubled years could have been avoided if only she, China, had been a better girl, more worthy. I am your guardian. She folded her hands on the table again. She leaned forward until her forehead was pressed to the backs of her thumbs, and she closed her eyes. The only close friend she'd ever had was Laura Templeton. Their relationship was something that she had wanted badly, but had never sought, desperately needed, but did little to nurture. It was purely a testament to Laura's vivaciousness, perseverance, and selflessness in the face of China's caution and reserve, a result of Laura's dear heart and her singular capacity to love. And now Laura was dead. I am your guardian. In Laura's room, under the dead gaze of Freud, China had knelt beside the bed and whispered to her shackled friend, I'll get you out of here. God, how it hurt to think of it. I'll get you out of here. Her stomach knotted excruciatingly with self-disgust. I'll find a weapon, she had promised. Laura, selfless to the end, had urged her to run, to get out. Don't die for me, Laura had said. But China had answered, I'll be back. Now here came grief again, swooping like a great dark bird into her heart, and she almost let its wings enfold her, too eager for the strange solace of those battering pinions, until she realized that she was using grief to knock humiliation from its perch. Grieving, she would have no room for self-loathing. I am your guardian. Although the clerk had never fired the revolver, she should have checked it, she should have known, somehow, some way. Though she could not possibly have known what Vess had done with the bullets, she should have known. Laura had always told her that she was too hard on herself, that she would never heal if she kept inflicting new bruises on the old in endless self-flagellation. But Laura was dead. I am your guardian. China's humiliation festered into shame, and if humiliation was a good tool for repressing terror, shame was even better. Steeping in shame, she knew no fear at all, even though she was in shackles in the house of a sadistic murderer, with no one in the world looking for her. Justice seemed served by her being there. Then she heard footsteps approaching. She raised her head and opened her eyes. The killer entered from the laundry room, evidently returning from the girl in the cellar. Without speaking to China, without glancing at her, as if she didn't exist, he went to the refrigerator, removed a carton of eggs, and put it on the counter beside the sink. He deftly broke 8 eggs into a bowl and threw the shells in the trash. He set the bowl in the refrigerator and proceeded to peel and chop a Bermuda onion. China hadn't eaten in more than 12 hours. Nonetheless, she was dismayed to discover that she was suddenly ravenous. The onion was the sweetest scent that she had ever known, and her mouth began to water. After so much blood, after losing the only close friend she'd ever had, it seemed heartless to have an appetite so soon. The killer put the chopped onion into a Tupperware container, snapped the lid tight, and placed it in the refrigerator beside the bowl of eggs. Next, he grated half a wedge of cheddar cheese into another Tupperware container. He was brisk and efficient in the kitchen, and he seemed to be enjoying himself. He kept his work area neat. He also washed his hands thoroughly between each task and dried them on a hand towel, not on the dish towel. Finally, the killer came to the dinette table. He sat across from China, relaxed and self-confident and college boy casual in his Dockers, braided belt and soft chambray shirt. Shame, which had seemed on the verge of consuming her, instead had burned itself out for the time being. A strange combination of smoldering anger and bitter despondency had replaced it. "Now," he said, "I'm sure you're hungry, and as soon as we have a little chat, I'll make cheese omelets with stacks of toast. But to earn your breakfast, you have to tell me who you are, where you were hiding at that service station, and why you're here." She glared at him. With a smile, he said, "Don't think you can hold out on me." She would be damned rather than tell him anything. "Here's how it is," he said. "I'll kill you anyway. I'm not sure how yet. Probably in front of Ariel. She's seen bodies before, but she's never been there at the moment itself, to hear that last scream and the sudden wetness of it all." China tried to keep her eyes on him, show no weakness. He said, "However I choose to do you, I'll make it a lot harder for you if you don't talk to me willingly. There are things I enjoy that can be done before or after you're dead. Cooperate, and I'll do them after." China tried unsuccessfully to see some sign of madness in his eyes, such a merry shade of blue. "Well, you're a sick son of a bitch." Smiling again, he said, "The last thing I expected you to be was tedious." "I know why you sewed shut his eyes and mouth," she said. "Ah, so you found him in the closet." "You raped him before you killed him, or while you killed him. You sewed his eyes shut because he'd seen, sewed his mouth shut because you're ashamed of what you did, and you're afraid that, even dead, he might tell someone." Unfazed, he said, "Actually, I didn't have sex with him."
"Liar."
"But if I had, I wouldn't have been embarrassed. You think I'm that unsophisticated? We're all bisexual, don't you think? I had the urge for a man sometimes, and with some of them I've indulged it. It's all sensation, just sensation."
"Maggot."
"I know what you're trying to do," he said amiably,
clearly amused by her.
"But it just won't work. You're hoping one insult or another will set me off, as if I'm some hair-trigger psychopath who'll just explode if you call me the right name, push the right button, maybe insult my mother or say nasty things about the Lord. Then you hope I'll kill you fast in a wild rage and get it over with."
China realized that he was right, although she had not been consciously aware of her own intentions. Failure, shame, and the helplessness of being shackled had reduced her to a despair that she had preferred not to consider. Now she was sickened less by him than by herself, wondering if she was a quitter and a loser after all, just like her mother.
"But I'm not a psychopath," he said.
"Then what are you?"
"Oh, call me a homicidal adventurer, or perhaps the only clear-thinking person you've ever met. Maggot works better for me."
He leaned forward in his chair.
"Here's the thing. Either you tell me all about yourself, everything I want to know, or I'll work on your face with a knife while you sit there. For every question you refuse to answer, I'll take off a piece, the lobe of an ear, the tip of your pretty nose, carve you like Scrimshaw."
He said this not threateningly, but matter-of-factly, and she knew that he had the stomach for it.
"I'll take all day," he said, "and you'll be insane long before you're dead."
"All right."
"All right what? Conversation or Scrimshaw?"
"Conversation."
"Good girl."
She was prepared to die if it came to that, but she saw no point in suffering needlessly.
"What's your name?"
he asked. "Shepherd. China Shepherd. C-H-Y-N-A.
"Ah, not a cryptic chant, after all."
"What?"
"Odd name."
"Is it?"
"Don't spar with me, China. Go on."
"All right, but first may I have something to drink? I'm dehydrated." At the sink, he drew a glass of water. He put 3 ice cubes in it. He started to bring it to her, then halted and said,
"I could add a slice of lemon."
She knew he wasn't joking. Home from the hunt, he was working now to recast himself from the role of savage stalker into that of accountant or clerk or real estate agent or car mechanic, or whatever it was that he did when he was passing for normal. Some sociopaths could put on a false persona that was more convincing than the best performances of the finest actors who had ever lived. And this man was probably one of those, although after immersion in wanton slaughter, he needed this period of adjustment to remind himself of the manners and courtesies of civilized society.
"No thanks," she said to the offer of lemon. "It's no trouble," he graciously assured her.
"Just the water." When he put the glass down, he slipped a cork-lined ceramic coaster under it. Then he sat across the table from her again. China was repelled by the prospect of drinking from a glass that he had handled, but she really was dehydrated. Her mouth was dry, and her throat was vaguely sore. Because of the cuffs, she picked up the glass in both hands. She knew that he was watching her for signs of fear. The water didn't slop around in the tumbler. The rim of the glass didn't chatter against her teeth. She truly wasn't afraid of him anymore, at least not for the moment, although maybe later, certainly later. Now her interior landscape was a desert under sullen skies, numbing desolation with the angry flicker of lightning toward a far horizon. She drank half of the water before she put the glass down.
"When I entered the room a moment ago," the killer said, "you were sitting with your hands folded, your head bowed against your hands. Were you praying?"
She thought about it. "No."
"There's no point lying to me."
"I'm not lying. I wasn't praying just then."
"But you do pray?"
"Sometimes."
"God fears me."
She waited. He said,
"God fears me. Those are words that can be made from the letters of my name."
"I see."
"Dragon seed."
"From the letters of your name," she said.
"Yes. And Forge of Rage."
"It's an interesting game."
"Names are interesting. Yours is passive, a place name for a first name. And Shepherd, bucolic, fuzzily, Christian. When I think of your name, I see an Asian peasant on a hillside with sheep, or a slant-eyed Christ making converts among the heathens."
He smiled, amused by his banter.
"But clearly your name doesn't define you well. You're not a passive person."
"I have been," she said, "most of my life."
"Really? Well, you weren't passive last night."
"Not last night," she agreed. "But until then."
"My name, on the other hand, is a power name. Edgler Foreman Vess."
He spelled it for her.
"Not Edgar. Edgler. Like on the edge. And Vess.
If you draw it out, it's like a serpent hissing. Demon. Yes, that's right. It's there in my name. Demon. Anger. He seemed pleased by her willingness to play.
You're good at this, especially considering that you don't have pen and paper.
Vessel, she said. That's in your name, too.
An easy one, but also semen. Vessel and semen, female and male. Would you like to craft an insult out of that, China?
Instead of replying, she picked up the glass and drank half of the remaining water. The ice cubes were cold against her teeth.
Now that you've wet your whistle,
Vess said,
I want to know all about you. Remember, Scrimshaw.
China told him everything, beginning with the moment that she had heard a scream while sitting at the guest bedroom window in the Templeton house. She delivered her account in a monotone, not by calculation, but because suddenly she could speak no other way. She tried to vary her inflection, put life into her words, but failed. The sound of her voice droning through the events of the night scared her as Edgler Vess no longer did. Her account came to her as if she were listening to someone else speak, and it was the voice of a lost and defeated person. She told herself that she was not defeated, that she still had hope, that she would get the best of this murderous bastard one way or another, but her inner voice lacked all conviction. In spite of China's spiritless recitation of events, Vess was a rapt listener. He began in a relaxed slouch, lounging back in his chair, but by the time that China finished, he was leaning forward with his arms on the table, hunched toward her. He interrupted her several times to ask questions. At the end, he sat for a while in contemplative silence. She could not bear to look at him. She folded her hands on the table, closed her eyes, and put her forehead against the backs of her church door thumbs, as she had been when Vess had come out of the laundry room. She wasn't praying this time either. She lacked the hope needed for prayer. After a few minutes, she heard Vess's chair slide back from the table. He got up. She heard him moving around, and then the familiar clatter of any cook being busy in any kitchen. She smelled butter heating in a pan, then browning onions. In the telling of her story, China had lost her appetite, and it didn't return with the aroma of the onions. Finally, Vess said,
"Funny that I didn't smell you right away at the Templetons."
"You can do that?" she asked without raising her head from her hands. "You can just smell people out as if you were a damn dog."
"Usually,"
he said, taking no offense, and with what seemed to be utmost seriousness.
"And you must have made a sound more than once through the night. You surely can't be that stealthy. Even your breathing I should have heard."
Then came the sound of a wire whisk vigorously beating eggs in a bowl. She smelled bread toasting.
"In a still house, with everyone dead, your movement should have made currents in the air, like a cool breath on the back of my neck, shivering the fine hairs on my hands. Your every movement should have been a different texture against my eyes, and when I walked through a space where you'd just been, I should have sensed the displacement of air caused by your passage."
He was stone crazy, so cute in his chambray shirt, with his beautiful blue eyes, his thick, dark hair combed straight back from his forehead, and the dimple in his left cheek, but pustulant and canker-ridden inside.
"My senses, you see, are unusually acute."
He ran the water in the sink. Without looking, she knew that he was rinsing the whisk. He wouldn't put it aside dirty. He said,
"My senses are so sharp because I've given myself to sensation. Sensation is my religion, you might say."
A sizzling arose, much louder than the cooking sound of onions, and a new aroma.
"But you are invisible to me," he said, "like a spirit. What makes you special?"
Bitter, she murmured against the tabletop.
"If I was special, would I be here in chains?"
Although China hadn't actually spoken to him and wouldn't have thought that he could hear her above the crisp sputtering of eggs and onions, Vess said,
"I suppose you're right."
Later, when he put the plates on the table, she raised her head and moved her hands.
"Rather than make you eat with your hands, I'm going to give you a fork," he said, "because I assume you see the pointlessness of throwing it and trying to stick me in the eye."
She nodded.
"Good girl."
On her plate was a plump four-egg omelet oozing cheddar cheese and stippled with sautéed onions. On top were three slices of a firm tomato and a sprinkling of chopped parsley. Two pieces of butter toast, each neatly sliced on the diagonal, were arranged to bracket the omelet. He refilled her water glass and added two more cubes of ice. Famished only a short while ago, China now could hardly tolerate the sight of food. She knew that she must eat, so she picked at the eggs and nibbled the toast, but she would never be able to finish all that he had given her. Vess ate with gusto, but not noisily or sloppily. His table manners were beyond reproach, and he used his napkin frequently to blot his lips. China was deep in her private grayness, and the more that Vess appeared to enjoy his breakfast, the more her own omelet began to taste like ashes.
You'd be quite attractive if you weren't so rumpled and sweaty, your face smudged with dirt, your hair straggly from the rain. Very attractive, I think. A real charmer under that grime. Maybe later I'll bathe you.
China Shepherd, untouched and alive. Uncannily, after a further silence, Edgler Vess said,
"Untouched and alive."
She knew that she had not spoken the prayer aloud.
"Untouched and alive," he repeated. "Is that what you said on the stairs earlier on your way down to Ariel?"
She stared at him speechless.
"Is it?"
Finally. "Yes."
"I've been wondering about it. You said your name and then those three words, though none of it made sense when I didn't know that China Shepherd was your name."
She looked away from him at the window. A Doberman roamed the backyard.
"Was it a prayer?"
he asked. In her desolation, China hadn't thought that he could scare her any more, but she had been wrong. His intuitiveness was frightening, and not entirely for reasons that she could understand. She looked away from the Doberman and met Vess's eyes. For one brief moment, she saw the dog within, a dark and merciless aspect.
"Was it a prayer?"
he asked again. "Yes."
"In your heart, China, deep in your heart, do you truly believe that God really exists? Be truthful now, not just with me, but with yourself."
At one time, not long ago, she had been just barely sure enough of what she believed to answer yes. Now she was silent.
"Even if God exists," Vess said, "does he know that you do?"
She took another bite of the omelet. It seemed greasier than before, the eggs and butter and cheese too rich cloyed in her mouth, and she could hardly swallow. She put down her fork. She was finished. She'd eaten no more than a third of her meal. Vess finished the food on his plate, washing it down with coffee that he didn't offer her, no doubt because he thought that she would try to throw the hot brew in his eyes.
"You look so glum,"
Vess said. She didn't reply.
"You're feeling like such a failure, aren't you? You failed poor Ariel, yourself, and God too, if he exists."
"What do you want with me?" she asked. She meant, why put me through this? Why not kill me and get it over with?
"I haven't figured that out yet," Vess said. "Whatever I do with you, it's got to be special. I feel you're special, whether you think you are or not, and whatever we do together should be intense."
She closed her eyes and wondered if she could find Narnia again after all these years. He said,
"I can't answer your questions as to what I want with you, but I have no doubt about what I want with Ariel. Would you like to hear what I intend to do with her?"
Most likely she was too old to believe in anything, even just a magic wardrobe. Vess's voice came out of her internal grayness, as if he lived there as well as in the real world.
"I asked you a question, China. Remember our bargain? You can either answer it or I'll slice off a piece of your face. Would you like to hear what I intend to do with Ariel?"
"I'm sure I know."
"Yes, some of it. Sex, that's obvious. She's a luscious piece. I haven't touched her yet, but I will. And I believe she's a virgin. At least in the days when she still talked, she said she was. And she didn't seem like the kind of girl who would lie."
Or there was the wild wood beyond the river, Ratty and Mole and Mr. Badger, green boughs hanging full in the summer sun, and Pan piping in the cool shadows under the trees.
"And I want to hear her crying," lost and crying. I want to smell the purity of her tears. I want to feel the exquisite texture of her screams, know the clean smell of them, and the taste of her terror. There's always that, always that.